Morning, I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us. It's Maryland Morning. We'll start today with an installment of our series, Living Questions, where we examine religion and ethics in the public sphere. This morning, a conversation with two environmental activists whose work is informed by their Muslim and Jewish faiths. Then, an intimate look at life in Northwest Baltimore with the creative brain trust behind the special series, Out of the Blocks. Aaron Henkin and Wendell Patrick give us a preview of the season premiere, which launches tomorrow afternoon here on 88.1. Plus, Dr. Sanjay Gupta speaks with Sheila Cast in advance of his appearance on the Baltimore Speaker Series, and theater critic J. Wynn Russick reviews Spell No. 7 at the Arena Players. Nathan Sterner has the local news. Maryland Morning starts right now with this hour's headlines.
I'm producer Jonna McCone. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
Thanks, Nathan, and good Monday morning to everybody on 88.1. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall, and we begin today with Living Questions, our monthly series in which we examine the role of religion in the public sphere. We're producing this series in partnership with the Institute for Christian and Jewish Studies. Last June, Pope Francis published an extraordinary encyclical on the environment. For the first time, the leader of the Catholic Church stated that climate change is real, that it's being caused mainly by human activity, and that it poses a particular threat to the world's poor. So now we're going to take a look at two initiatives that place the challenge of climate change front and center in the faith traditions of Islam and Judaism. Joining me here in Studio A is Corey Majid. She's the founder of Green Ramadan, a grassroots organization that promotes environmentalism during the Ramadan holiday and year-round. Ms. Majid, thank you so much for your time this morning.
I'm so happy to be here.
Glad to have you. And Rabbi Arthur Wasko is the founder and co-director of the Shalom Center in Philadelphia. He was one of seven rabbis who wrote their own version of the papal encyclica. It's called A Rabbinical Letter on the Climate Crisis, which has been signed by more than 400 rabbis, and he joins us on the line this morning from Philadelphia. Rabbi, good morning. How are you doing?
Morning. Shalom. And assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam.
We're glad to have you both here. So Corey Majid, Islamic leaders meeting at a global summit in Turkey earlier this year called on the world's 1.6 billion Muslims to combat climate change and to obey the Quran's directive to live in harmony with nature. Your organization has been up and running for about 3 years. What inspired you to launch Green Ramadan?
Well, during Ramadan, we don't eat from sunrise to sunset. And at the end of that day, we want, you know, we're really thinking about eating. And so we get to eat. And there's this one moment in particular where there was a table set full of dates in styrofoam bowls. And people picked up the styrofoam bowl, ate the dates, threw it away. And that bowl was used for less than a minute, less 30 seconds. And it just touched my heart. It was just so, so wasteful. And I didn't want Ramadan to be like that. Ramadan shouldn't be like that. We're so mindful of what we're eating because we're not eating. And then when it comes to eating, there's so much waste afterwards, and we forget that part. We're not as mindful of what happens after the eating.
Mm-hmm. So give us a couple of examples from the Green Ramadan website, your suggestions for zero trash iftar meals. The iftar is the meal in which you break the fast, usually done in community during Ramadan. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, at the end of the day, you go to the masjid or the mosque, or, you know, your family or people at home. So what can you do? You can use reusables. When you're at home, at least when I'm at home, I use, you know, a plate, you know, wash it, use it again. But at the mosque, they'll use paper or styrofoam disposable stuff. And so just think 30 days of that, how much trash our local mosque creates or eating together creates. So use reusables. Go vegetarian. Sometimes Muslims like to eat meat, but sometimes going vegetarian is good. It's good for you and it's good for the environment. Eating local and organic. That helps our local economies, using water wisely. Muslims have a connection with water because we use the water to make wudu, a ritual purification before we pray. Don't turn that tap on all the way, make it go to a trickle and use it wisely. Lots of different ways that Muslims can be more mindful during Ramadan.
Yeah, and Rabbi Mosco, in your rabbinical letter, what is your essential message?
The essential message is that out of ancient Jewish teaching, when the Jewish people was still an indigenous people of shepherds and farmers living in a land where the connection with the land was the most sacred relationship they had to get in touch with God, that we can draw from that some very powerful teachings that now apply to the planet as a whole, not just to one little sliver of land on the eastern Mediterranean. For example, the whole idea that every seventh year there is a pause in, for an entire year, a pause in, you might say, forceful agriculture. What grows by itself grows and you eat, but you do not do an organized plowing, sowing, reaping, etc. The land gets to rest. And the Torah says the land is entitled to have its own Shabbat, its own Sabbath, every seventh year, a sabbatical year. Well, it's clear that now, and the rabbinic letter said that, we are making the earth overwork. And the worst way we are making it overwork is by pouring much too much CO2 and methane into it for the plants and the trees, etc., of the planet to absorb. And so we're heating the place out of possibility. So then we had, then the rabbinic letter shifted from drawing on Jewish wisdom of the past into, so what do we do now? And one of the major areas we talked about was what we called move our money, protect our planet, which we didn't plan it that way in the first place, but it turned out the initials of move our money, protect our planet, or mom, pop. So we thought that was a gift from God, and we named several ways. For example, synagogues and Jewish homes, and in fact, we wrote the letter to the world, not just to the Jewish people. So every house of worship, every organized building, every home could shift buying its electricity from coal-fired plants to wind and solar initiated electricity. That would also have the benefit of ending coal-fired plants where now they're mostly situated in black and poor neighborhoods because they didn't have the political power to stop it, and they become centers of asthma epidemics from the results of the coal dust in the neighborhood. So there would be both local and planetary good effects from moving away from coal and away from oil. And then we named a series of other ways as well in which we could move our money.
On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. You're listening to the latest installment of Living Questions, our series on religion in the public sphere. Joining me on the phone, Rabbi Arthur Waskow. He's the founder and co-director of the Shalom Center in Philadelphia. Corey Majid is the Washington-based founder of Green Ramadan that promotes environmentalism with Muslims. She is with me here in the studio. I'm Tom Hall. Corey Majid, this green faith movement that you and Rabbi Moscow are part of. There was a big summit, if you will, of a multi-faith summit that happened earlier this summer to talk about these very issues. Does it appear to you that because there's so much commonality in what you and Rabbi Waskow are trying to accomplish, is environmentalism a point of commonality and a point of departure for interfaith dialogue that can be productive between Muslims and Jews, for example?
Definitely. The Islamic Declaration on Global Climate Change, it kind of addressed that. And it addressed that in a way that Muslims would be familiar with. So in the Quran, it says for us to compete for the good. And the Islamic declaration actually gave like a nudge to other faith groups. Hey, let's compete for this good. So this definitely a way for all faith groups to work together.
And Rabbi, I mean, do you run the risk of being overtly political when you start talking about moving money? Moving money, for example, away from oil to solar or to wind power. Obviously, there are many Muslim countries that rely on oil. Could this be yet another example of a point of contention between the two faiths?
Well, it's not only Muslim or Arab countries, or yes, Muslim ones too, Iran, but oil from the North Sea, for example, from Canada, the tar sands attempt to use tar sands from Venezuela. The point is, none of us, including Saudi Arabia, Iran, Iraq, none of us are going to survive without really terrible scars if the planet as a whole does not drastically and ideally, totally, end its dependence on fossil fuels. I was really moved by the Islamic statement and by the Pope's statement. The rabbinic letter, in fact, back in February, all the way back in February, we heard from contacts of the Vatican that they were beginning to work on an encyclical. And we here at the Shalom Center asked ourselves, so the Jewish people doesn't have a pope. What is our analog? And what we felt was a statement by rabbis from all the streams of Judaism would be as near as we can do to a kind of authoritative statement of what Torah Judaism means about this, and that's where we began. We actually did not see the encyclical until a couple of days after we published the rabbinic letter, and I was really happy at how closely the two really track each other. The Pope didn't just say, listen, this CO2 stuff is a bad idea. He said, listen, there are entities, companies with enormous power and enormous wealth that are imposing this on us, and there are desperately poor people who are going to be, or already, and even worse, going to be the brunt of the results. And we had said the same thing with less elaboration and less, we didn't want to spend.
Well, Rabbi Waskow, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it.
All right,
glad to have you.
You
here. And Corey Magee, we appreciate your
I'm
time as well.
I'm glad we came out, all three of our traditions, so close together.
Indeed. You've been listening. That's Rabbi Arthur Waskow from the Shalom Center. Corey Magee is the Washington-based founder of Green Ramadan. I'm Tom Hall. You've been listening to Living Questions. Coming up after a break for news, Aaron Henkin and Wendell Patrick join me for a preview of the season premiere of Out of the Blocks. Mr. Sterner, it's all yours.
Thanks, Tom. You're listening to the Maryland Morning Podcast, a service of your public radio, WYPR, in Baltimore. Find more podcasts at WYPR.org and tell us what you think by email, mdmorning@WYPR.org. Now, back to the podcast.
Tomorrow afternoon at 1 o'clock, as Nathan has mentioned earlier this morning, right here on WYPR, producer Aaron Henkin and musician Wendell Patrick will unveil their season-opening installment of Out of the Blocks. They're a series that gives us an intimate look into the lives of people who live and work on one specific block in Baltimore. In the past, they've taken us to Greenmount Avenue in Waverly, to Patapsco Avenue in South Baltimore, and right after the unrest in April, they took us to the Penn North intersection. That was the epicenter of much of the violence. Tomorrow, they'll introduce us to folks in the 4700 block of Liberty Heights Avenue in Northwest Baltimore. And this morning, Aaron Henkin and Wendell Patrick join me here in Studio A with a preview. Good to see you both.
Hi, Tom Hall.
Good to see you.
So, Aaron, there was no joy in Mudville when it was announced earlier that the Signal would be on hiatus. Tell us how that's going to work and why that happened. And that's, I guess, happened so that you can concentrate on this series. Huh?
Sure. Yeah. The situation is such that, Wendell and I worked on this Out of the Blocks project, this series, this concept for several years now. It takes us up till now. It takes us about 2 years to get one done because, you know, Wendell is a musician, producer. He's a, you know, he's otherwise employed trying to make ends meet as a creative person here in Baltimore. I had The Signal, which I worked on with Lisa Morgan every week for, and so this always ended up on the back burner. We got a grant, several grants actually, this year, thanks to helpful folks here at the station. And so now we have the money to make this happen, and also importantly, I've set aside The Signal to have the time to make this happen as well.
So you're going to do six episodes all total this season at some point. They'll happen every.
We're going to try and knock one out about one every 8 weeks, which is a substantial acceleration from one every 2 years.
Yeah. And Wendell, this idea grew out of a project that you did for The Signal. It sounds like you didn't really know what it was going to be like when you embarked on it, but it turned out to be really compelling and really successful.
Yeah, well, the beginnings of this show actually, at least for me, came when Aaron asked me if he could actually use some of my music from my albums for this idea that he had. We didn't know each other well at the time. I had met him a couple of times actually on The Signal. And so we met, and he shared the idea about going to one block, interviewing everybody on the block, and he wanted to use my music. And I thought, said to him, what would be really cool is if I actually scored the whole thing like a film. And so that was really where that began. But yes, I had no idea how broad it would become.
Yeah. Let's listen to a clip. This is a woman named Jean Johnson. Can you tell us a little bit, Aaron, about Jean Johnson?
Sure. Yeah. So, you know, on this block, there are people who've been there many, many decades, as well as, you know, very relative newcomers. Jean Johnson has been there, I think, 30 or 40 years. She runs a consignment shop. I won't say too much about her because you're about to hear her, but she's really one of the, she's got a great institutional memory of this place and just a beautiful personality.
All right, here's Jean Johnson.
We have a rack of clothing here, women's clothing, and mainly you have suits and dresses, all colors, all sizes, just a different variety. I'm Jean Johnson, 4734 Liberty Heights Avenue, and I run Repute Neely New Shop. It's a consignment shop, and I sell used clothing for people, and I do a 50-50 split when I sell the merchandise. I take in mostly women's apparel, accessories, hats, clothing, jewelry, pocketbooks. Fashion has always interested me, and I am doing what I enjoy doing. I love what I do. I love opening this door to this shop every morning to come in and to see the customers come in. I enjoy this. This is my calling. Good morning, Repute. Well, good morning, dear heart. How are you doing? You ended up with 20. It was 23, and I gave you a little discount, so you ended up with 20, darling. I'm your girlfriend, and I'm your girlfriend. I close at 4, Charlotte. All right, baby. Okay. I love you back. All right. Bye, sugar. Bye-bye.
Jean Johnson from Out of the Blocks, which will make its premiere tomorrow afternoon at 1 o'clock here on WYPR. So, Aaron Henkin, it's a very different relationship when you're doing a project like this and you're taking a lot of time with each of the people that you're speaking with. It's not like the three of us sitting in the studio doing an interview, in quotes.
Right. Yeah, I mean, that clip, I'm glad you chose that because it's a beautiful example of, you know, what can happen if you just spend time with people. I mean, the interview as such, you sort of hear her answering questions that I have asked during the first part of that segment. But really, I think the most sort of beautiful moment is just having the microphone on when she's on the phone with one of her customers. I mean, that's when you really get a sense of being able to, you know, be a fly in the wall and, you know, in one of these spaces on this block.
Let's listen to another clip. This is a gentleman called Youssef. Again, this is from the 4700 block of Liberty Heights Avenue in Northwest.
Youssef Ali from Libby Heights and Gwen Oak. I hustle. I thought I'd be a millionaire by now, long as I've been in the game. But right now, my life is really in shambles, man. I got kid on the way. My life is really wild right now.
How so? Say more about that. Like, what's chaotic about it?
Like, you wouldn't know. I sell narcotics. So, like, right now, I got enemies around.
Talk about how that happens. I mean, how do you make enemies?
I might take something from somebody. I might rob somebody. You think they're gonna just lay down and this guy just took my money and I ain't doing nothing to him. I ain't gonna do nothing back.
But you feel like it's worth the risk then?
If you got a record like mine, like the jobs are not hiring. They're looking at your record. Oh, you the second three-time felon. You can't. Nah, we ain't having that. You know.
So Wendell Patrick, the music, the score of this is just fantastic. It's so terrific. And as we heard, very different music for Gene Johnson, the mm-hmm. shop owner, and than it was for Yusef Ali. Gene Johnson sort of reminded me of Eric Satie's Gymnopédie, the little piano thing. Yes. Do you aim to sort of have, you know, Wagner called them leitmotifs, sort of, you know, tunes that are associated with each particular individual? How do you approach the challenge of scoring these interviews?
The first thing I do is I go with Aaron when he goes to the block. And so by the time I'm writing the music, I've actually spent a lot of time with all of the subjects as well. And really, you know, during the time I'm down there just talking to them, just watching them move, watching how they interact, I'm already sort of thinking about what to write in terms of the feel. But really, I just try to sort of capture not only the qualities of the person, but also something that will sort of match what it is that they're saying.
And Aaron Hankin, how do you pick the blocks, and mm-hmm. then how do you pick the people you talk to on the blocks?
Right. Well, that first question is sort of hard to answer. The second question is very easy to answer.
Because you talk to everybody.
We have to, once we pick a block, the sort of the rules of the game are, you know, our motto is one block, 1 hour radio, everybody's story. So once you pick the block, you're sort of, you know, all in. You know, Wendell and I, we drive around the city a lot, we walk around the city a lot, and we just check in with each other about, have you ever seen this block on Monument Street or Eastern Avenue or Liberty Heights Avenue? And, you know, we pick blocks that are kind of like backbone of Baltimore blocks that are uncelebrated blocks in the sense that, you know, there's nothing on that block that makes them a media darling. There's no great sort of revered cultural institutions per se, according to the mainstream media. And, but they're just, there's just a beautiful ballet of city life happening. People mm-hmm. on the streets, we mom and pop shops, and just kind of unsung quintessential Baltimore blocks.
On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Aaron Hankin and Wendell Patrick join me in the studio. We're giving a little preview of Out of the Blocks, which will premiere tomorrow afternoon on 88.1 at 1 o'clock. Let's listen now to another clip from the series. This is a gentleman called Anthony Arnold.
Seen it rain this hard in a long time.
Well, I guess God say he gonna bless the earth. Name is Anthony D. Arnold, 4701 Liberty Heights Avenue, Baltimore, Maryland. My story is I'm a former MTA bus driver. I drove for 32 years, been retired for 8 years. I'm enjoying life to the fullest. But I'm a man of modest means. The people that I done came up with died when I was a teenager because they was living that fast life. But more or less is, hey, I made it through the Richter scale, through that crack. 60 years old, just turned 60 this year. I'm just getting started. God said he telling the truth. That's why he hit that thunder.
So So, Wendell Patrick, as you mentioned, you're with Aaron, where you guys are on the block talking to each of these folks. You're also not only getting ideas for sound, for music to accompany these stories, but you're also shooting pictures, and those are on the website as well.
Yes.
Are you looking to do a particular kind of thing with the video and the stills that you're shooting?
You know, I've always been, since I've been doing photography, I've been a huge fan of documentary style photography. And so what's really great about this show is it gives me an opportunity to do that and marry it with another art form that that's also very dear and important to me. So I'm really just trying to sort of capture them in their element. The pictures are, I think, raw and, you know, that basically allow them to tell their story visually and also allow people to match a visual to what they're hearing if they go to the website.
Yeah, so there's an out-of-the-box web page that folks can consult. So, Aaron yes. Hinken, obviously the unrest that happened in April brought to the fore of people's consciousness the tremendous tension between the police and the community, the African-American community in particular. You talked to people in Northwest. What did you learn about that tension? What did you learn about the potential for trust to be rebuilt or built between police and the citizens?
Great question. You know, Wendell and I met a lot of guys, a lot of young guys who are, you know, out on the street doing whatever they're doing, independent entrepreneurs, call them what you will. And I think to a person, they all said basically that, you know, I'd ask, I'd say, are you more afraid of, like, each other or the police? And 201, it became very clear that the relationship with the police is extremely sour. We also met a retired cop, Henry Sorrell. You'll hear him in the show, and he was on the force in that district. That was his beat. He walked that beat in the 60s. He said, we walked the beat because they didn't give us a car. And I asked him if he had any advice for current police officers. He said, get to know your people. So, yeah, you'll hear it referred to. I mean, it's just part of the fabric of any conversation in Baltimore now. And it's part of this episode of Out of the Blocks.
And Wendell Patrick, just a few seconds as we finish up here. Does it take a long time for people to loosen up? I mean, I assume you record hours and hours and hours of tape and then, you know, distill it into this great show. Does it take a while for folks to get into the vibe?
You know, it depends. There are some people that are upfront and really want to participate. There's others that you have to spend some time with in order for them to feel comfortable. But that's just all, you know, a part of the process.
Yeah, well, we look forward to it tomorrow. Aaron Hinken and Wendell Patrick, thanks for your time, you guys, and break a leg with the show.
Thanks so much.
These guys are the creative brain trust behind Out of the Blocks, excuse me, which has its season premiere tomorrow afternoon, 1 o'clock. It will also be rebroadcast on Wednesday evening at 8 o'clock. You can catch it all, as well as any of the other episodes of this terrific series, on WYPR.org/out-of-the-blocks. By the way, one more program note, while we're at it, tomorrow night at 9 o'clock here on 88.1, please join me for the October edition of Choral Arts Classics. My guest will be the internationally acclaimed soprano, Hyuna Yu. Gentlemen, thanks again. I'm Tom Hall. It's Maryland Morning. Stay with us. The Arena Players in Baltimore is the oldest African-American community theater in the United States. They began making theater in 1953, and that theater making continues this week with a production of Spell No. 7. Maryland Morning theater critic Jaywin Russick has her weekly review.
Entesaki Shange created a sensation with her 1975 play for colored girls who have considered suicide when the rainbow is enough. Her groundbreaking, heartbreaking celebration of African-American women was televised in 1982 and made into a feature film with an all-star cast just 5 years ago. Arena Players produced its own impressive take on For Colored Girls in 1995. Now it has boldly mounted one of the playwright's lesser-known works, Spell No. 7. Like For Colored Girls, Spell No. 7 doesn't have a traditional plot. Instead, it's structured around a series of Shange's distinctive choreo poems. But this time, the cast includes men, and the play offers a look at the place that brings its nine characters together. That place is a New York bar, a hangout for African-American theater folk. They express their frustrations, unwind, regale each other with stories, and occasionally break into song and dance. The bar is presided over by a bartender named Eli, who's also a poet. Benny Pope portrays Eli as a man who takes pride in his art and his bar.
Carelessness and other priorities are not permitted within these walls. I am mantling an array of strength and beauty. No one shall interfere with this. The construction of myself, my city, my theater, my bar.
Limited opportunities account for many of the frustrations faced by Eli's clientele. A large minstrel face is painted on the back wall of designer Andrea Crew's set at Arena Players. It's an image and a stereotype that Eli's patrons are eager to shed. But in this era before colorblind casting, the play debuted in 1979, few directors or producers could see beyond the stereotype. Eli's waitress, Lily, is a classically trained actress, but she doesn't fit the physical stereotype. Christian Harris leans back and launches into Lily's lament about being unable to get work because of the limited vision of directors and producers.
They said I was too light to work. When I asked him what he meant by that, he said, well, I didn't actually look black. I said, well, my mama knows I'm black, and my daddy damn sure knows I'm black. But it's just that he's the only one with a problem and that thinks I'm not black. I said, oh, okay, all right, so just let me play a white girl.
Our guide through the play is a magician named Lou, nimbly played by Morgan State University student Brandon Shaw. This is black magic you're looking at, the magician says. Loving being colored, as he puts it, is spell number 7. Director and choreographer Mary Andrea Travis proves to be somewhat of a magician herself, keeping the monologue, snippets of choral speech, and occasional conversations flowing swiftly. She deftly incorporates dance into the musical selections in the script, from a send-up of minstrel acts performed to Bill Haley's Hambone to the exuberant steps that accompany Bob Marley's Is This Love. Most of the performers bring individualized flair to their characters, but Mackenzie Williams is a standout, whether playing a disturbed woman unable to cope with her baby or delivering a sarcastic monologue as a white housewife flinging her hair, popping Valium, and remaining ignorant of the world. Although the theater world has become more hospitable and inclusive since Entesaki Shange wrote Spell Number 7 36 years ago, the broader theme of racism remains sadly relevant, and a discussion of immigration restrictions feels ripped from the headlines. The original stage directions for Spell Number 7 call for the use of masks at the start of the play. Director Travis eliminates this, but the set's omnipresent painting of a grinning minstrel face summons up Paul Lawrence Dunbar's We Wear the Mask That Grins and Lies. At Arena Players, Spell Number 7 shows us the face behind the mask.
I put a spell on you.
Theater critic J. Wynn Russick. The Arena Players production of Spell Number 7 continues in Baltimore until Sunday. We've got details on our website, wipr.org/Maryland Morning. Coming up, WIPR's Sheila Cast talks with Dr. Sanjay Gupta from CNN. But first, here's our very own Doctor of the Morning Drive, Nathan Stern.
Thanks, Tom. You're listening to the Maryland Morning Podcast, a service of your public radio, WIPR, in Baltimore. Find more podcasts at WIPR.org and tell us what you think by email, mdmorning@WIPR.org. Now, back to the podcast.
On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. CNN's medical correspondent Sanjay Gupta will be in town tomorrow for the Baltimore Speaker Series presented by Stevenson University. He's a journalist and multiple Emmy Award winner, and he's also a practicing neurosurgeon, the associate chief of neurosurgery at Grady Memorial Hospital in Atlanta, and an assistant professor of neurosurgery at Emory University. WIPR's Sheila Cast is the host of the Baltimore Speaker Series. She spoke with Dr. Gupta last week.
Early this month on CNN, you highlighted an approach to gun violence that calls for it to be treated as a public health issue, like an infection that spreads from person to person. You said that idea gives you hope. Why?
Well, you know, we talk about gun violence, obviously, in the wake of tragedies. But what I thought was so striking about some of the work that's been done by people like Gary Slutkin is sort of thinking about the root cause of these things. In medicine, you want to figure out the root cause of something and treat that as opposed to symptoms. And I think the idea of violence overall being something that behaves like an infection. You can predict infectious diseases, you can predict how they're going to spread, and that's really a very good thing for doctors who are trying to control those infectious diseases. What these guys saw, these researchers, was that violence behaves in much the same way. It can start very small, it can spread predictably among populations, and has outcomes that people can see coming. So when you think about violence as a root cause, and you start to interrupt that violence, that sort of is much closer to treating the root cause of the problem. And I think that's what was optimistic about it.
Baltimore's health commissioner, Dr. Lena Wen, agrees with you. Her department sponsors a program called Safe Streets Baltimore, which relies on former offenders to interrupt violence in their communities. There was an incident this summer. Guns and drug paraphernalia were found in one of the Safe Streets offices in East Baltimore. Two Safe Streets workers were arrested. The city has since reopened that office, a vote of confidence in the program. But how do you assess the risk of relying on ex-offenders to be those interrupters of violence?
Well, if you keep the medical analogy, there's always potential side effects, potential concerns whenever you're giving a antibiotic, for example, for an infection. But I think, you know, on the other hand, you have people who probably understand the motivations and the root cause of the violence better than anybody. So, you know, I think if people who now have a genuine interest in saying, look, I've been there, I know how to fix this. I think this is a fixable problem, and I think I can help fix it. I think, you know, that in some ways they're going to offer a lot of assets and benefits that other people cannot.
Let me share with listeners part of how Playboy magazine set up its interview with you last summer. Quote, he now juggles time in the operating room with his CNN gig and as a special correspondent for CBS News, where he occasionally appears on 60 Minutes. Since that pace is too breezy, Gupta writes novels, competes in triathlons. Before his first race at the age of 40, he taught himself to swim by watching YouTube videos and spends quality time with his wife and three young daughters, close quote. Do you really do all that? And if so, how?
You know what's funny, Sheila, is that I read that kind of stuff about other people as well, and I think that's, you know, that isn't sort of incredible, but I never think of myself sort of that way, so it's funny to hear you sort of read it out loud. I'll give you some specifics on how I sort of organize my life, because I think there's probably relevance for everybody in there, but first of all, I'll tell you, I'm not an expert. It all evolved. I didn't walk in sort of knowing how I was going to organize these types of things into my life, and I feel very blessed to be able to do it. I mean, you know, we all have a limited time on Earth, and I think being able to do as much as you can do, contribute in as many ways as you can contribute, I think is just important. That's my mom and dad taught me, and I try and teach my kids. So that's how I approach life. But you know, I have a schedule. I schedule things. I've been like that since I was a kid. I just schedule my life, and in a realistic, yet very consistent way. I don't give myself unlimited time to do things. I find if you give yourself unlimited time to write a paper in the afternoon, you will take all the time that you can possibly take. But if you say I have an hour and a half to do this, and keep yourself on a schedule, all of a sudden you find that you can be much more efficient. I don't think of medicine and media part of my life as totally disparate silos. I see them, you know, part of the same spectrum. So I learn a lot of things in my journalism career, which I apply to medicine and vice versa. So, you know, I kind of feel like I'm a perpetual student, and I get to learn and then maybe even teach what I've learned through various channels.
But let me pick up on that, because, as you know better than I, there was quite a bit of controversy this spring about your dual roles. It started with a surgery in which you participated in Nepal after the earthquake there, where you ended up misidentifying the patient. You thought it was an 8-year-old girl when it turned out she hadn't needed surgery, and it was a 15-year-old girl that you had participated in the operation. But some in the press use that as an occasion to question why you perform surgeries on camera in disaster zones and whether that needlessly confuses the goals of journalism with the goals of medicine.
It's an interesting thing, and I don't know there's an absolutely right answer to this question. I mean, in some ways it's something that I've been, you know, thinking about since I've started this sort of dual career. In this particular situation, it was I was in an earthquake zone. Doctors there asked me to help operate on somebody. They told me who the patient was and all of that, and I had no reason to question what they were telling me in terms of the patient's identity. I knew the patient I was operating on certainly needed an operation. That was obvious. Subsequently, it was 3 months later when they themselves sort of realized that the girl that was operated on was this person as opposed to that person. And, you know, you obviously, you know, as journalists, you want to make sure you get those things absolutely right, but you're sometimes beholden in disaster zones to what the hospital's telling you. As far as why do it, you know, I mean, they asked me to help out, and I did. We didn't have our cameras in the operating room; those were iPhone cameras that took pictures and video of the operation. That was not one of our CNN cameras, and some of those images are then released. Another reporter wrote an article about it, and then people asked me, you know, as some of that was released. So certainly not my intent. You know, I go there to report the stories. I think it's important to report those stories. But I also think that if someone, you know, putting on a press badge is not a part of your humanity. You know, if people ask you to help, you help.
If you had to choose between your media career and your medical career, which would you choose?
You know, medicine's my first love. I like the tangible aspects of medicine. I do. I have a lot of respect for journalists. I love my career as a journalist, but medicine has a tangible nature to it. That, you know, I wake up in the morning on days that I'm operating, and I know what I'm supposed to do that day. You know, it's very clear. It feels really good to be able to be a doctor. And you know, I have young kids now, and they ask me about their own lives and what they want to do, and I still think, you know, being in medicine or being in some field of compassionate care, there's nothing quite like it.
The neurosurgeon and CNN correspondent and host, Dr. Sanjay Gupta. He spoke with the host of Midday, Sheila Cast, last week. Dr. Gupta is speaking tomorrow evening at the Meyerhoff Symphony Hall in Baltimore as part of the Baltimore Speaker Series presented by Stevenson University and hosted by Sheila Cast. We've got more information and more of this interview on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. That'll do it for us this morning. Coming up Wednesday, the director of the Howard Conservancy, the author of a new book about Vladimir Nabokov and the nutrition diva, will all stop by Studio A. I hope you'll join us Wednesday morning on Maryland Morning. For Nathan Sterner, I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.